The novel Daniel Deronda's preeminent sympathiser is Daniel Deronda himself. And like Dorothea Brooke in the earlier novel, Daniel's sympathy has a quality of diffusiveness. At the end of Middlemarch, the very final paragraph makes a reference to the incalculable quality of Dorothea's diffusive sort of effect. But here, diffusiveness has become a problem. Daniel's many-sided sympathy, he can sympathise easily with all sorts of people, is precisely what hinders his action. He can't act. It's plenteous and flexible, but it neutralises action precisely because of that. In short, and the passage that describes this isn't actually very short, it sort of revolves around and around this issue of sympathy, repeating its formula again and again. But this is, in essence, what it says about Daniel, what the narrator says. A too reflective and diffuse sympathy was in danger of paralysing in him that indignation against wrong and that selectness of fellowship that are the conditions of moral force. And these words, reflection, reflective analysis, reflectiveness, are repeated terms in a kind of echoing series of sentences about sympathy. It's as if one meaning of reflection, namely a kind of cognitive, imaginative work of sympathy we saw taking place in Dorothea, reflection associated with reason, has here turned into something more like a kind of uncontrolled mirroring that dissipates energy and identity. Sympathy stripped of the connotations of rational mental activity, of careful and deep thought that draws on past experience, or of introspective self-awareness. And it's left only with this sense of a kind of mirroring and a more kind of automatic, unwilled process where Daniel's buffeted from person to person. It blows, his sympathy blows Daniel hither and thither. What braces him and rescues him from this uncertain state is meeting the Jewish man Mordecai and discovering that he is himself in fact Jewish. Following a fateful trip he makes to Genoa to meet his mother, he returns when he discovers his real inheritance. He returns home impatient to be reunited with his newfound Jewish destiny. And this is what the narrator writes. It was as if he had found an added soul in finding his ancestry. His judgment no longer wandering in the mazes of impartial sympathy, but choosing with that noble partiality which is man's best strength, the closer fellowship that makes sympathy practical, exchanging that bird's eye reasonableness which soars to avoid preference and loses all sense of quality for the generous reasonableness of drawing shoulder to shoulder with men of like inheritance. Those two reasonablenesses sort of tug on me, they snag on me when I read them, as if they're doing too much work to both achieve and, in a sense, diffuse the opposition they describe. And I think we should also be a little bit surprised by the adjectival qualifier of the second and preferred form of reasonableness, the generous reasonableness, the type of generous reasonableness, because I think it's absolutely without question, without doubt, that for most Victorians, most of the time, the task of drawing shoulder to shoulder with kin, or with extrapolations of kin, men of like inheritance, is the natural, or you might say the ethically easy, the morally easy position to adopt, where generosity is in fact least in need. What's happened, surely we have to ask, to Eliot's core value of realist art, that it must widen our sympathies. There is nothing I should care more to do than rouse the imagination of men and women to a vision of human claims in those races of their fellow men who most differ from them in customs and beliefs, Eliot writes. And she's actually writing about this novel. earlier in the novel, while he's walking the Jewish areas of London, trying to find the Jewish woman Myra's relatives, her brother, and worrying about the potential that Myra might be related to the Jewish shopkeepers he's looking at in the East End, the narrator makes one of those broader assessments of Daniel's nature that are, in the quote I've been talking about, this quote, overturned. It lay in Daniel's nature usually to condemn the feeble, fastidious sympathy which shrinks from the broad life of mankind. What kind of pressure then is Daniel under, where we, you know, in a sense he ends up shrinking from the broad life of mankind and cleaving to this more circumscribed type of sympathy with his own kind, if you like, with the Jewish people, where he seems to now forget the commitment to the broad life of mankind. Okay, they're just a couple of examples of really what I'm trying to suggest at the moment, which is something is unsettling about sympathy in this final novel, Daniel Deronda. And there's a great deal more that I could say about it, and I think that there's there to say about it. But I need to move on now, to just leave us really with that sense of sympathy being unsettled. With just one further point that I want to emphasise before I move on to the second the final section, really. In the 1870s, the decade in which this novel is written, sympathy, as I've mentioned earlier, is starting to be discussed in scientific circles. Darwin writes about it as an instinct shared with other social animals in his book Descent of Man, that's published at the beginning of the 1870s. And it begins to be intensively debated in the emerging discipline of psychology, which I've already mentioned, which Eliot thought considered the supremely interesting element in the thinking of our time. Her partner, of course, was a psychologist. Victorian psychology, at this moment anyway, is beginning to understand, well, perhaps not beginning, it does understand mind as a part of nature. Mind's an accompaniment of natural processes, and like the body of which it's a part, it's a product of evolution. It's not a divinely endowed or special category. The actions of human consciousness or will are now being explained by psychologists by reference to the reflex nervous system, or the localization of brain function, not explained by a special or transcendental or God-given capacity. Now, Eliot's no simple biological determinist. She's much too complex a thinker for that. But what I'm suggesting here, I think, in relation to this last book, is that these new evolutionary configurations of sympathy as a biological product, as a form of kind of instinctual automatic response derived from the long processes of adaptation and natural selection, a part of what shapes the tensions and the peculiarities of Eliot's final novel. Sorry, I'm drifting, aren't I? Okay. So it's via these scientific debates, the psychological debates, especially as they begin to grapple with a materialist account of these higher faculties like sympathy and the love of beauty, aesthetic sorts of categories, that I'm now going to jump forward two decades to the final part of this paper and to the first signs, the first intimations of what will come to be called empathy. Born, I'm going to argue, empathy's born out of the intellectual conditions that are attempting to fit sympathy into a wider naturalistic account of how and why human creatures experience feelings or emotions in the way that they do. So my final section is Vernon Lee and empathy. In 1884, the American philosopher William James, the brother of the novelist Henry, published an essay that gained quite a lot of notice and a bit of notoriety. It was called What is an Emotion? And it appeared in the journal Mind. And in it, James sought to overturn the common sequence in which the bodily changes associated with emotional states, so things like hair rising on the back of your neck, limbs trembling, heart racing, and so on, are seen as reactions to those states. So fear, in this instance, I feel fear and my body changes. On the contrary, James insisted, the sequence actually works the other way round. The body responds to environmental stimuli, and the feeling that results is a consequence of these changes, not their cause. We fear because we tremble, not tremble because we fear. All emotions, James argues, even in fact the most complex and supposedly civilised ones, depend upon reflex corporeal change. So effectively I'm a body machine and I respond to stimuli, and the feeling is just a kind of after effect of what's happening in my reflex body. James's hypothesis attracted the attention of Vernon Lee, who, as I said earlier, was born Violet Paget. British by nationality, Lee was a real cosmopolitan intellectual. She spoke several European languages, and her main home was in Italy. She travelled extensively around Europe. And she was a vivid presence in the intellectual, literary and artistic circles of the fin de siècle. She was strongly attracted to women, and empathy's strange career in Britain began after she'd fallen in love with a Scottish woman, artist Clementina, or Kit, Anstruther Thompson, who she met in 1887. The tall, athletic, and aristocratic Kit had come to Italy to nurse Lee's sickly brother. Kit was bowled over by Lee's intellectual prowess and her familiarity with the major intellectuals, artists, and writers of the day. She knew Oscar Wilde and Henry James and Walter Pater and Robert Browning and John Sargent and so on. The picture I showed earlier was painted by Sargent. Lee was bowled over with Kit's beauty and also with her remarkable, spontaneous bodily reactions to art. Together, throughout much of the early part of the 1890s, the two women went around Europe's art galleries. They saw themselves as investigating the question of what art does with us. Lee believed that aesthetics had come of age where it needed to be understood scientifically, and that experimental psychology held the key to that understanding. She urgently sought, and she thought it was urgent and needed, a new and revitalised account of the moral force of art. She'd become critical of Ruskin, John Ruskin, who she initially adored, but she saw his creed increasingly as ascetic, Puritan. But she also found the aestheticism of the circles that she was involved in often trivial. She was definitely not a kind of art for art's sake junkie. A different account of art must be possible, and Lee believed she'd found it in Anstruther Thompson's body. Standing before an object, Kit experienced physiological changes in her balance, in her respiration, and in her muscle contraction. And these bodily changes caused her to feel varied emotional states, such as, for example, suffocating constriction if the object was kind of cramped, or expansiveness and vitality and harmony. Borrowing from James's thesis, it's the somatic changes in her body that give rise to the accompanying states of feeling. The body, in a sense, mimics the form. So her one of her famous examples is of a chair, and she talks about planting her feet in relation to the chair legs, and the way that her lungs, the right and left side of her lungs, fill up with air depending on the symmetry of the object that she's looking at. These kind of, they're almost visceral, really. She talks a lot about her lungs, kind of visceral changes in her body that change the way that she feels. So she mimics the object, and the body's movements, their internal movements, maybe ease her breathing or release muscular tension, and this in turn increases the sense of well-being and vitality, and that's the feeling that's projected back into the object and experienced as if it belongs to the object. And that's why you find an object beautiful or not beautiful depending on the feeling that you've projected back into it. That's at least what Lee thought. They published their findings in a long two-part essay in 1897. It wasn't noticed much in England, except for a minor plagiarism dispute, but I don't have time to go into that. But in Germany, as I've said, the leading site of experimental psychology, a philosopher called Theodor Lips reviewed the essay. He was quite harsh about it, but he recognised in the women's ideas something close to his own extrapolations of the workings of Einfühlung. Einfühlung was defined as the feeling into an object, which explained, Theodor Lips contended, the power of form. Form, the Doric column is Lips's famous example, provokes in the viewer of it a dynamic sense of movement, ups and downs, for example. So ups and downs are not in the nature of a column. It's us doing the ups and downs in our own body, our eyes and our heads maybe. We're doing the movement. But that feeling is projected back into the object, so we understand the form in terms of its up and downness. Such at least is Lips's argument. As Lee later glosses it, we give away our motion to objects. This had become a new buzzword of German psychological aesthetics, Einfühlung. There's a little definition of it there. A mechanism for explaining, so its enthusiasts argue, the mystery of why some things strike us as beautiful. Lee later explained that when we think of landscapes rolling and flowing, or arches soaring, or belfries pointing, they're actually doing what we should feel ourselves doing if we were inside them. For we are inside them, she insists. We have felt ourselves, projected our own experience into them. The discovery of this projection of our inner experience into the forms which we see and realise is the central discovery of modern aesthetics, she writes. During the first decade of the 20th century, Einfühlung was discussed in the specialist psychological and philosophical press in Britain and the US. It was usually translated as aesthetic sympathy or just sympathy, picking up on the sense of sympathy as a kind of mimicry or imitation, until around 1908, an experimental psychologist working at Cornell University suggested the term empathy. And empathy was soon being used to designate the projection of feeling into other people as well as into objects. Okay, I'm getting towards the end. Lee's relationship with Anstruther Thompson painfully disintegrated in the years after the women wrote their initial 1897 article. No longer buoyed by love, and always resolutely unsuccessful in detecting in her own body the sorts of changes Kit described, although she tried incredibly hard to feel her lungs filling with air when she looked at art, Lee came to see more and more empathy as primarily a psychological, not a physiological response. Taking her cue from Lips, she began to focus on the way in which the lines, angles, and planes that constitute the form of objects call forth our own dynamic experience of movement, of being alive, in other words. We can recognise a shape or form, Lee says, but when we really dwell on an object, when we really attend to it, we realise, not just recognise, but realise the relations of the shape's constituent elements, because our own dynamic experience is projected into it. The dynamic experience is our experience of being alive, but also, Lee argued, the dynamic, motional and emotional experience of the past, and indeed that imagined in the future. Einfühlung or empathy is a process involving ideas of movement, ideas made out of the accumulated and synthesized, Lee often called it abstracted memory store of all our experiences of motor activity, out of imagined similar movements and out of an unconscious knowledge of primordial dynamism as such, which for Lee is tantamount to life. And it's this that lends the ethical force to art. Beauty literally keeps us alive. Now, in all Lee's published writing that I've read, empathy is only ever used to describe the relation of a viewer or hearer towards an object. But I've tracked down at last at least one occasion on which she writes of empathy as a process taking place towards other humans. And I'm going to close with that because I think it helps to clarify the similarities and differences between empathy and Eliot's sympathy. In June 1915, in the midst of war, and Vernon Lee was a passionate pacifist, Lee was invited to address the famous Cambridge Heretic Society on the topic of war, group emotion and art. The talk, in part, was an attack on an avant-garde artistic movement in France called Unanimism that extolled the virtues of the group in an attempt to revalue the negative theories of groups that had swept over Europe from around 1900 via the work of figures like Gustave Le Bon, who wrote a famous book on the crowd. And the crowd in Le Bon's work is characterised always by loss of reason and the domination of contagious emotions. So the crowd, the group, is always liable to be atavistic, violent and cruel. These theories of the group are, of course, newly potent because of the war. The unanimists, by contrast, saw the group as a radical breaking down of egoism and the basis of a new collective, better notion of subjectivity. But Lee couldn't go along with either. The question remained urgent for her in the crisis of war. Where to go to, except back to the individual, the one, if you reject the group, the crowd, the communality? If the group's dangerous, what do you have left? Have you necessarily got to go back to the individual? And what can the individual be except rational if, like in crowd theory, emotion is always dangerous and contagious? They were the questions that Lee was trying to work through. And her answer was that the individual is not one, and that art is where we realise that. Not because it invites us to identify with characters, all the types of narrative inducements to sympathy that we associate with a realist novel, but actually through its formal characteristics, the dynamic qualities of lines and planes, rhythms and language in this process of empathy. So she advocates what she calls something more akin to rationality, but not the reason traditionally and habitually opposed to emotion. I think she means something more like emotion that's akin to rationality. And this is what she writes. It's quite a sort of dense thing. But she writes, "I hold that it is not present personal emotion which enables us to come in touch with the life of others, but something more akin to that rationality whose verbal formula is not I feel, I want, but it is. It's memory that provides the key to understanding this abstract formula, individual and social memory, unconscious memory, as the Victorian critic and writer Samuel Butler called it, links present individual selves to what Lee calls the residual, abstracted, purified, intensified, and essential feelings of the past. Changing the I into a sort of shared it. It's a kind of non-solipsistic it. It's this past that makes art meaningful. It taps an ever-multiplying organic capital of past emotion, enabling us to live every now and then outside our own life, into the life of the unknown, the distant, and sometimes the imaginary. Empathy describes this feeling into an object when it triggers these stored up and abstracted feelings. And Lee continues, she had long implicitly held that such empathy, such stored up, depersonalized past emotional experience of our own is the real source of our power of entering into the feelings of other human beings. So through empathy, we abstract ourselves, we release ourselves from the solipsistic confinement of our limiting egoism and partake in history and humanity. Lee's is a radically different version of the overcoming of egoism than Eliot's, but it reaches for something like the same moral goal. And it's at least, at the very least, interesting that one version of early empathy was so explicitly striving to reconfigure the very notion of subjectivity, of individuality, and as a result to answer what's always been the most negative view of empathy as a kind of appropriation. So I feel your pain, effectively equating to I stand in your place and sort of annihilate you, and my pain becomes the most important thing. I don't allow you any space or any difference from me. Okay, really nearly finished now. In 1921, Kit Anstruther Thompson died, and mourning for her, Lee looked back at their work together and thought again about the possibility that empathy's workings might just in the end be explained by the brain in the body. Future neurologists will very probably discover the portions of our brains and nervous systems, that is to say of our bodies, upon whose processes such mental phenomena are dependent. Today, in the 21st century, the dynamism of neuroscience has given us mirror neurons, named by a group of scientists in Italy in the 1990s as they watched on MRI scans monkeys eat nuts and what happens in their brains when they eat nuts and when they watch other monkeys eat nuts. Mirror neurons are claimed to explain the evolution of language and the development of culture. That's at least the claim of one of those scientists, Giacomo Rizzolatti. For enthusiasts, they are at the centre of the neuroscientific revolution, the last in the line of decentering theories in which we learn this time that we are nothing but a pack of neurons, at least according to V.S. Ramachandran, the so-called Marco Polo of neuroscience, as Richard Dawkins has named him, who's director of the Centre for Brain and Cognition at UC San Diego. Mirror neurons explain empathy and, quotes, empathy puts the brakes on violence, empathy allows communication, empathy allows one to understand another's behaviour, empathy allows altruism, so says Simon Baron Cohen at the University of Cambridge. Do you need any more reasons, he writes, to justify the importance of empathy? No, perhaps not, but the 19th century can, I think, still teach us important things about the need to reinterrogate the attractions of having a materialist understanding of bodies, minds, and brains, such as today's neuroscience enticingly seems to offer us. Why they remain so powerful, why those dreams of finding that part of your brain that makes you feel for others, how they affect what a person is and what they can be. Thank you very much.